Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. And, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it is Monday morning, and that's what we do. We hear my dad tell a joke. That's coming up. We've got the Monday morning movie reviews this week. Not much, new movie stuff here. We'll do the box office as well. Eric Childress and Jim Laskowski, Jim in for Colin. Are going to be joining me in just a couple of seconds. And we've got a lot more to talk about here a little bit later on. We also have some mind-blowing facts that we'll get to, as well as much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. Well, it is Monday morning, and that means it's time for the movie reviews. Let's bring the guys here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's get to it. Jim, why don't you start us off with The Possession of Hannah Grace?
All righty. So this is a new horror movie that came out this week, directed by a Dutch filmmaker whose name I can't pronounce, but he's mainly worked in television, which is also the case for the screenwriter who wrote a number of episodes for shows like Teen Wolf and MTV's Scream series. So we begin with the only exorcism in the film, in which a young girl named Hannah Grace is possessed by a demon and manages to do a lot of damage early on. And then since the exorcism itself kind of goes awry, she winds up being suffocated by essentially her father. And then suddenly we just jump to 3 months later, and we're following somebody completely different. We're following a former cop named Megan, played by Shay Mitchell, who has been struggling with drug and alcohol addiction ever since her partner was gunned down in the line of duty, and she feels responsible for that. She decides that working the overnight shift at a hospital morgue is the best way to get herself out of the house and into a routine again, in order to sort of escape the temptations that she used to rely on and possibly enjoy some peace and quiet in a nighttime setting. And on her second night at work, I believe, a corpse for Hannah Grace arrives and is dropped off and is kind of mangled and twisted. And Megan quickly realizes that this new arrival isn't any normal corpse. And also you may be wondering why her body arrives 3 months after what we just saw at the very beginning. So let's just say from that point forward, Megan has to endure a lot of bumps in the night, we'll say, some disappearances, as well as the possibility that Hannah Grace may not actually be dead in the traditional sense of the word. So it's essentially then up to Megan to find a way to stop the evil forces before it's too late for all involved. And at the same time, she has to fight off her anxieties, which she used to treat with prescription medications. So there's the initial setup there. And, you know, I do love a good horror movie, and certainly there have been many, many films about possession and demons and hauntings, and they're always welcome. I'm always interested in seeing them. Not to mention that it sort of takes a bit of a cue from the Evil Dead remake in portraying a little allegory about addiction being its own type of possession in of itself. So the writer and director here try to make this a bit more of a human story than just a series of jump scares and screams. So that I can commend it for, since they're trying to elevate it a little bit. And I think Shay Mitchell does her best with a character that is struggling with her past and her present as well. It's trying to find that balance between horror and drama, but ultimately not very successfully, especially in comparison to what we got with Hereditary earlier this year or something like The Babadook a while back. The fact is that this movie isn't very scary. I mean, it has a couple of creepy scenes. One in particular where I thought of your claustrophobia, Nick, because someone gets trapped in one of those morgue drawers, lying on their back, and it's not pleasant. But I mean, it's one of the more effective scenes, even if it's brief. And it's it's straightforward in ways that aren't very surprising in the end, especially when you think of a much better film like The Autopsy of Jane Doe and the place that film decided to go with kind of a similar setup and setting. I will say you could do a whole lot worse. This is only 86 minutes, but it ends up being a predictable, kind of slow-going experience that you hope would lead to a great payoff, and it kind of doesn't. I would just say, you know, it's not entirely a waste, but it's well shot, well acted, and like I said, doesn't rely on jump scares in the way that, you know, I've grown very tired of at this point. I think, you know, there's a lot of long silences, and the score doesn't, like, raise to a crescendo every time something freaky happens, so that was a nice surprise. But overall, it's just kind of a mediocre, rather lazy horror film that doesn't really transcend the genre or offer anything new or special. So, unfortunately, I cannot recommend The Possession of Hannah Grace, though it's not as awful. It's not as awful as some people are saying it is.
Okay,
in my opinion.
All right, there you go. So that's The Possession of Hannah Grace, and it's not as terrible as a lot of people are saying it is. Okay. All right.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, Eric.
Yeah.
Tell us about Burning.
Okay, Burning is the latest film from Lee Chang-dong, who did the films Poetry and Secret Sunshine, and the movie's set in Korea, and the young man named Jung-soo is just kind of wandering around his neighborhood and bumps into an old acquaintance of his, a young woman that they grew up together. He doesn't quite remember her, or at least recognize her now as an adult, but she certainly does. And she decides for them to catch up, which they do. Leads quickly into a sexual relationship. And also an opportunity for him to look after her cat while she goes on a trip to Africa, which he does, now kind of fully versed in wanting to be a part of her life, at least for the good sex. He agrees to do that. But when she returns from Africa, she has returned with a more upscale gentleman played by Steven Yeun from The Walking Dead, he, you know, is bringing this guy back, and there clearly is a friendship between them, possibly more, and he's just kind of always kind of hanging on. He's always invited to wherever the two of them are going to be. He's clearly comes from money. What he was doing on this trip, we're not exactly sure, and it leads to this, you know, this kind of slow burn of exactly who this guy is, what the relationship between these three characters are going to be, and, you know, kind of ultimately starts to, you know, evolve into the sort of a class warfare kind of thing. The Yoon character is described at one point as one of the many Gatsbys that lives in Korea. And this is a, you know, when I say slow burn, this is a movie that runs almost 2.5 hours long, and while I was watching it, you're kind of trying to solve the puzzle a little bit, trying to figure out exactly what the relationship is, you know, who this guy is, where this movie is actually headed, you know, just ultimately, well, you know, how all these things are going to fit together. There's, you know, instances involving the Hai Mi character where she, you might not exactly be telling the truth about her past and about their past and even her present. So there's a lot of questions about what is reality, what is not, you know, people imagining things, you know, exactly what is going on here. And watching the movie is a really kind of interesting experience. It's even more fascinating after all the pieces fit together, because is when they do is when the movie, I could not get the film out of my head. It's something I've been thinking about for better part of a week now. And I think anyone who's kind of ever been in any kind of situation where you have feelings for somebody and they bring along a dude with them everywhere they go, it's like that episode of Seinfeld where Jerry's dating Amanda Peet and the dude is always in her apartment.
Right.
I kept thinking about that during the movie. Also, the French guy from Cheers who kept wanting to steal Woody's girlfriend. You know, these are the things that I went to just to try to keep myself sane watching this stuff, because there's a real tension that develops. And Yoon is so good in this movie. You do not know where this character is coming from. You know, is he just a guy? Is he a sociopath? We're not exactly sure. There are a lot of twists and turns that this movie takes. The stuff about this kind of the class warfare that's going on, the sort of the they mentioned that the North Korea and the sort of the propaganda and stuff over there is brought up. There's really creepy stuff throughout this movie. The title refers to all different kinds of thematic elements going on throughout the movie. Each character has something to do with the title in the film. And when this thing kind of all comes together, it's just something that is just really kind of sticks with you. And I'm really looking forward to watching it again, now knowing exactly how everything fits together, because there are a lot of clues and a lot of manipulation going on in this movie. It's a long one, but it's a very rewarding one.
Okay. All right. Guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay. That's Eric talking about the movie Burning, and then we'll find out what Jim thought of it, and I'll tell you what I thought of it as well. That's all coming up right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time, and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page. It's the best way, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, a few movies to review this week, and right before the break, Eric told us about this film called Burning, and that he liked it quite a bit. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, Jim, what did you think of Burning?
Well, I'm pretty much aligned with Eric here. I really liked it while I was watching it, but then thinking about it later, I really ended up kind of loving it. I mean, it's a hard movie to decipher in terms of what type of movie it is while watching it, because at first glance, you think it's going to be this sort of love triangle, and, you know, it is for a while, and then it sort of becomes this mystery that really, you know, envelops you. But it's also really, really raw at times and kind of unpredictable. There's a really remarkably prolonged sequence that takes place at the farm where she starts dancing to Miles Davis with her arms kind of raised to the sky while stoned and intoxicated. And the camera uncomfortably lingers on the setting. And that might be one of my favorite movies, or one of my favorite moments of the year, really, like that whole moment. But it's really an interesting choice to make our main protagonist kind of socially awkward, too, and not very expressive, or at least has a very hard time even communicating with the object of his affection. But, I mean, it also just creates a really interesting contrast, like Eric was mentioning, to this more magnetic character. And he seems to have it all together. He seems to have a really nice home. And there's just a lot of, you know, also kind of like socioeconomic ideas throughout the film. But it's also very existential. I thought about it a lot. And, you know, it's this character study that also at moments kind of drops in these snippets of commentary where, I mean, there was even a moment where our current president talks about immigration on the TV in the background. And I was like, well, that's an interesting choice. So it becomes a movie with a lot of questions and very few answers, which I could see being frustrated for some, but for the more, you know, intellectual, curious film buffs, I think they're going to really get something out of this entire experience, because for me, like, it ends up being a movie about absence, you know, just not having something when you want it, or, you know, it's you know, the idea of something disappearing is really scary, and it's really tension-inducing as the film progresses. things keep being taken away for the main character, and I think it just creates this heightened sense that something is just wrong in this, world, and I'm not sure exactly where it's going to take me, but I loved where it ended up taking me, and the score is really remarkable, too, and like Eric said, it is a slow burn, but I think it's a powerful one with a lot to say, and a lot of feelings were sort of conjured up in me as I watched it, and I reflect on it later. So I think this is one of the year's more interesting and very best films. So I'm going to be watching this one again within the week for sure, and I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, this is a really interesting film, and I liked it quite a bit. It is this is the kind of film that like you really get enveloped by while you're watching it. And it is sort of has this great sort of like hypnotic effect on the audience as you watch it. And you're also, you're trying to figure out where it's going and what's going on. There's a lot of ambiguity in the movie as well, but I think the performances are all good. Steven Yeun he's phenomenal in it. Completely different than the kind of things that you see him that you've seen him do on The Walking Dead. This is a movie that really, once it gets its hooks into you, you can barely shake it, and it goes out. I mean, it is a long movie; it's 2.5 hours long, but it's never boring. And it's never less than really compelling and interesting and, really complicated. It's a film that really just really gets under your skin in a good way, in a really, really good way. I thought all the performances were good. This is a movie that you really don't know where it's going to go. That's one of the things that I really loved about it was that, you can't predict anything that's going to happen in this movie. It is a really, really terrific movie. And I liked it. I liked it a lot, and I look forward to watching it again. And like you guys said, it's one of these things where now I've only seen it the one time, but I want to watch it again now, knowing like you said, Eric, knowing now where all the pieces fall. It probably has. I mean, I'm sure the second viewing of this movie would be a completely different experience than the first time you watch it, knowing where it goes and what happens. But this is a terrific movie. It's only playing at the Music Box. And again, all three of us are recommending it. It's called Burning, and it's a pretty great movie. So,
and if you do get to see it a second time, I think really pay attention to her character, because we're sort of following this main guy. We do follow this main guy throughout the entire movie, and the sort of the idea of who exactly is in love with whom. Is a real sort of an interesting way balance shift that happens right around that farm scene that you're talking about, Jim. The tail end of that scene, the very end of that scene, you really kind of get a sense of where the Jaime character has been coming from the entire movie, and it's really heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's terrific stuff.
For sure.
It's terrific stuff. Okay, so there you go. That's Burning. All right. All right, Jim, why don't you tell us about The Favorite?
Okay, well, this is the latest from Yorgos Lanthimos, who's brought us such lighthearted fare like Dogtooth, The Lobster, and most recently The Killing of a Sacred Deer. This is apparently based on real events from the history of the British monarchy. It takes us into the world of privileged, complicated, and seemingly private relationships shared between three very powerful and uniquely motivated women. We have Queen Anne herself, played by Olivia Colman, who is kind of ailed by various forms of sickness and personal trauma, and also just a lot of anxieties, having to, basically run a system of government. And there's also the commanding and often brutally honest Lady Sarah, played by Rachel Weisz, who helps run the kingdom in Anne's place more often than not, and is kind of the assistant to the queen, but also maybe more than that. And finally, we have a new arrival to the palace with a young but determined Abigail, played by Emma Stone, who is intent on improving her social standing and kind of move up to a higher position of power, if possible. Yeah, you might say that each may have control issues to some extent, but then, Abigail kind of witnesses some behind-the-scenes interactions between Sarah and the Queen that sets in motion some rather difficult decisions, I guess you could say, that each begin to make that affect their own lives as well as the relationships instilled already. And in the background, we also get to see that the parliament is mainly this, you know, a man's political realm, with the women not really finding a lot of support there, especially when you have the treacherous Robert Harley, played by Nicholas Holt, and he's sort of trying to manipulate things within the system. And the other male characters, too, are merely just kind of window dressing, more occupied with how they look than the well-being of all involved. So the film ultimately becomes focused on dependence and toxic relationships and takes us in the minds of two women vying for the attention of the Queen, and we get to sort of experience the damage it may or may not cause as a result. I'm a huge fan of this director ever since seeing Dogtooth, which, you know, is remarkably disturbing. That's kind of how I put it at the time when I was like, it sort of had that pitch black humor that wouldn't be out of place in the world of like Todd Solondz, but it was also really, really unique. And The Lobster I thought was mostly great, and I actually really responded strongly to his last film, I believe it was last year. But I honestly think that his latest might be his best and his most consistent and his most entertaining. I mean, I know one friend of mine actually found it to be almost too conventional for a daring director that likes to take huge risks and do really weird things in his movies, but I didn't find that to be the case. I didn't find this to be conventional. I found it to be we use the word enveloping, that sort of does that with the camera work here, but also just these actresses command the screen more than any actresses working today. I mean, certainly they're going to be talked about come award season, and deservedly so. And I also thought the camera work was just graceful and gorgeous, with a lot of oblique angles and these fisheye lens shots. Very unique touch, and the score gets very eerie and haunting at times, but it's also very Baroque and playful. The set and production design is impeccable. I just got really caught up in the dynamics and the relationships between all three of these women, even when they were just downright cruel and calculating towards one another. So I found it to be this really sort of smart and caustic portrayal of like codependence. And it certainly, you know, adds a lot of emotional weight when you realize the demons that the Queen, you know, has in her past that sort of fuels her neuroses throughout. And, you know, there are great little touches here, like the meaning behind her rabbits, along with little, various little animals that pop up. And just a lot of great mean-spirited dialogue. I mean, it's very darkly comedic in that sense. But it's also, you know, an interesting love story, and it's political and personal. I mean, I had a strong feeling that I was going to love this movie based on the trailer, and I'm glad that I was right. And I think most people who see this will have a lot to say about it afterwards, which is always a sign of a great movie for me. So, again, this is one of the year's absolute best films, if not my favorite so far.
All right. Hang on, guys, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay. Eric and Jim are here, and we're talking about the movie The Favorite, and I'll give you my thoughts on it, and so will Eric right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning, and we're doing the movie reviews here, the Monday morning movie reviews, and my dad will call in and tell a joke. We also have yet another disappointing Blackhawks Express to play. Which has been pretty consistently depressing lately, but we'll play that back as well. And that's also coming up. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, before the break, Jim told us about The Favorite, which is the new movie featuring Rachel Weisz, Olivia Colman, and Emma Stone. And now we're going to find out what Eric thought of it. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right. Eric, where do you stand on The Favorite?
Well, like with Burning, when I left at the screening of it, I wanted to sort of give this movie time to sort of ruminate and to see exactly where I fell on the side of this one, and I didn't take as much time to ruminate as I have with Burning. I am ultimately giving the film a recommendation, though I don't clearly like it as much as Jim did. I think the first two-thirds of the movie are very entertaining. The one-upsmanship that the women are doing, you know, the Vice and the Stone characters are doing to each other, and the way that they're, you know, attempting to manipulate Coleman, and the interactions with the really hilarious Nicholas Holt, who's really great in the film. It's a very odd About a Boy reunion. when the two of them are plotting and scheming, I think the film was very interesting. Once you get to a point where one of the three characters is kind of separated from the group for a little while, and she's kind of out of play for a bit, that's when the movie started to lose me a bit. And the movie, for me, just kind of limped its way towards this conclusion. I think there's one really fascinating twist in the final act of the movie that I wish there was actually more about. But I was just like, oh, that's kind of fascinating. And then it just kind of, you know, ends the way it does. And I just got to a point where, as much fun as it was to watch these characters, I didn't really care about who was going to win this battle, how historical it is or not. I just didn't really care that much, and it just doesn't, to me, it didn't really amount to a whole lot of, what the scheming is going to be, and it just kind of, ends with on kind of a note of be careful what you wish for, which, is kind of an interesting way to end the film, but it ultimately, just kind of reconfirmed my suspicions that I really didn't care who won this battle. I liked the characters when they were scheming against each other, but, by the time it was over, it was just kind of like, yeah, I enjoyed a good part of it, but it's not a movie that's really going to stick with me much further than that.
Yeah. This is one of my favorite movies of the year. I loved it. I thought it was great. And, I can't say enough about these three performances. These women are phenomenal in this movie. And Olivia Colman is just remarkable in this film. I loved everything about it. I thought the scheming between the two women and the politics of what's going on. And you're right about Nicholas Holt. He's hilarious and terrific in this movie. I think it's beautifully photographed. I was with it, I was with the personal interactions between these three characters and what was going on politically. The power struggle between them and everything, and the manipulations that are happening throughout the thing. I think everybody's great in this movie. Emma Stone is just phenomenal. She's perfectly cast in this movie, and Rachel Weisz is just awesome in the movie. It's one of her best roles in a long, long, long time. I think it's beautifully directed. I was on board 100% throughout the entire movie. It was like, to me, it was like Barry Lyndon plus All About Eve with a little Monty Python thrown in and some Hammer horror. And all of that stuff is great, in my opinion. and I just love the combination of it, and I really did. I was with it all the way. I thought it was really funny, like laugh out loud funny at times, and just a beautiful thing to look at. I mean, just on the simplest of levels, this is a remarkably beautiful film in terms of photography and production design and costumes and all that stuff. I mean, this is as good as it gets. I was intrigued by the politics of what was happening. I cared about these characters. I did have some investment in who was going to win this battle or who was going to win these battles and the politics of what was happening between these women. It was a joy to watch. I can't wait to see it again. And I just, I think it's just great. And I think these three women deserve every accolade that they can get. I think the performances are phenomenal, and I was with this movie 100% from the beginning all the way through to the end, and I loved it. And I think it's a, I think it might be his best film as a director. And it's certainly different than the other films that he's done. It's certainly like tonally, it's a different kind of a film. But yet I think it's a great movie, a really, really great movie. It's one of my favorites of the year. So anyway, that's The Favorite. Okay. Well, that's it for this week.
Yeah.
Not much.
The opposite of last weekend.
Yeah, exactly. So what do we got next week? Next week we've got Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, right?
That's right.
And
boy, yeah.
And what else?
Another Jungle Book movie.
Another Jungle Book movie, right?
Premiering on Netflix.
It's going to be on Netflix. Okay. And so
Anna and the Apocalypse.
Anna and the Apocalypse.
A zombie musical.
That's right. I've seen the trailer for it. you know, could be worse. All right. Eric, you hang on, okay?
Sure.
Jim, thanks, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks,
all right,
man.
See you later. There you go. When we come back, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Eric and I will talk about the box office right here on 720 WGN. And that'll be coming up right after we take this break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning, here till 5 a.m. My dad will be calling in and telling a joke, and we've got some amazing facts that you're going to be stunned by, and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, 312-981-7200 for talk and text, and you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, and the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, we reviewed the new movies, and Eric is sticking around, and we're going to talk about box office now. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, any surprise by the box office this week, or no?
Not really. I mean, there's pretty much, you know, with the Possession of Hannah Grace is the only wide opener this week. We didn't expect that to make a whole lot of money. Everyone just kind of stayed the course.
Yeah.
Pretty much where it was. Ralph Breaks the Internet, taking the number one slot, not a surprise. Took a little bit of a bigger dip than I think some people were expecting. I think some people were thinking that it could clear $30 million. It only cleared a little over $25 million.
Right.
So it still has a chance. It's probably going to be on pace to come right around what the original movie did. It might still be able to make $200 million with, pretty much nothing opening next week as well. But it's doing just fine.
Yeah. So that's Ralph Breaks the Internet. $25.7 million. Its total is $119.2 million total.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, that's kind of on par of what the first one did.
Right. Yeah. The first one finished with $189 million, and that's right around what this movie is pacing at the moment to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Number two is The Grinch, $17.7 million. That's up to over $200 million. Wow.
Yeah, it's ahead. It's just ahead of the pace of where the Ron Howard movie was back in 2000, and it's still on pace to do somewhere around $240-$250 million, which is pretty much what I was expecting the movie to do. So it's not doing great business overseas just yet. Neither did the Jim Carrey movie, actually. So maybe The Grinch is kind of a decidedly American story, but we'll see. I'm sure it's going to do well enough. The movie is already a hit for them, but we'll see exactly what its worldwide gross ends up with.
Okay, number three is Creed 2 with $16.8 million. How is that doing compared to the first one?
It's doing very well, actually. It's outpacing the original right now. It's actually on an estimate of around $125 million finish right now. The first film finished with $109 million. So, that dip this week was pretty solid, and expected to do somewhere in the vicinity of $125 million.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. All right, and then number four, Fantastic Beasts, the Crimes of Grindelwald, $11.2 million, $134 million total. That's underperforming.
Underperforming in the U.S., not in the world. This weekend it passed, it became the 15th film this year to pass the $500 million mark worldwide. So Warner Brothers, you know, this movie is an international success, this franchise is, and as long as people keep going to see it overseas, if the declining grosses in the U.S., you know, are a little bit here, a little bit there, they'll take it. Mm. And they have to, because they got three more movies to make.
Right. Right. Okay. Now, number five, wow, Bohemian Rhapsody, still $8.1 million, $164 million total.
Yeah, there's a very good possibility that this movie, at least in the U.S., outgrosses Fantastic Beasts.
Wow.
And I don't know anyone who had that on their, you know, their score chart at the beginning of the season. But this is going to be the 16th film to break $500 million worldwide. It is at $493 million worldwide.
Wow.
Right now.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
That really
yeah,
is unbelievable.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Wow. And I hated it.
Just imagine how much it would have made if it was a good movie.
Yeah, I know. That's number six, Instant Family, $7 million. It's up to almost $46 million. And is that about right for the Mark Wahlberg family comedy?
Well, it's a better stretch. I mean, it didn't start very well, so it's going to stretch itself to somewhere around $60 million. So it's a good kind of hold. It gets held on. Word of mouth has been obviously pretty good on it. But the movie cost $48 million.
Oh, it did?
So, yeah. How? I don't know.
Wow.
I mean, I guess half of that is Wahlberg's salary. I don't know how that movie cost $48 million. But it did, and because of that, you know, it's not going to be some sort of international sensation. This movie's eventually going to lose money.
Yeah. Jeez. Wow, $48 million. Jeez.
Yeah.
Number seven is The Possession of Hannah Gray, $6.5 million. Nobody expected that to make any money, right?
No. I think $6.5 million is, I mean, I think they'll take that, frankly, because that movie could have ended up making a lot less. It only cost $9.5 million. It's not going to be some huge bomb or anything like that. It is probably going to lose money eventually, because it looks like it's probably not going to get to $20 million. It's going to need at least around $23-25 million to break even. So you know they got it out there and they're going to get a little bit of their money back, I guess.
I don't know, but to me, it just seems like a weird time to release a horror movie. You know?
Well, they haven't learned. Hollywood has not learned not to release horror movies during the holidays, with the exception of like Scream, you know, which just,
right.
just kind of took everybody by surprise. It didn't open well. That was just a word of mouth thing,
right?
But you know, you think like The Mist, and I mean, the year before Victor Frankenstein,
right?
Like this is not the time to release these type of movies,
right? Right. Okay. It just seems weird. Number eight,
yeah.
Robin Hood, $4.7 million. Oh my God, $21 million total. Oh, how much did this one cost?
Well, it cost a cool $100 million.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, $100 million, and again, I get they must have thought that they were making something for the international market here, but at that cost, that's a lot of money. They have to be making Kingsman money. To pull this off, and I don't think this is going to end up making Kingsman money.
Yeah.
Certainly not in the U.S.
Wow, man. Whoa.
Yeah.
Number nine, Widows, $4.4 million. It's only up to $33 million. Why aren't more people seeing this movie?
I don't know. I don't know. I honestly, I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, it doesn't exactly have. I mean, while it has like one of the greatest casts of the year,
yeah.
It's not exactly a cast that brings in people.
Right.
You know, that's the problem. I mean, it's got one of the best ensembles of the year, Oscar-worthy ensemble cast. But, you know, Viola Davis, you know, people don't just leap at a Viola Davis movie even as much as they say they love her.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's really unfortunate. I mean, I don't think that there's anything Fox could have done to improve the grosses on this. It was out there for the festivals. The word of mouth was out there. You know, it's like, I don't know what they could have done,
yeah.
Frankly.
I'm really disappointed that people aren't going to see this movie. I mean, this movie should be a big hit. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it absolutely should be. I mean, when we walked out of it at Toronto, you know, people were assumed it was like a $100 million hit. Like, it was going to be that, you know, it was going to be an adult hit during the season, a crowd pleaser, twists and turns, all the kind of things that people go to the movies for, and it just hasn't taken off.
It's just ridiculous, I think.
Yeah.
It's too bad, because it's a really good movie.
Okay,
number 10, Green Book, $3.9 million. Is that just in limited release?
It's still in just 1,000 screens. I'm going to see where exactly this movie goes, but I think Universal really missed their window here. These 2 weeks, this week and next week, where there's nothing opening. They expanded this thing to 1,000 screens last week. They only added 2 theaters this weekend. They should have gotten this thing out there to over 2,000 screens this weekend. and you know, made this thing climb the charts a little bit, because, you know, as much as we don't want to, you know, give box office a credit, it's kind of a chicken and the egg kind of thing. People see a movie start rising in the charts, people are talking about it, and all of a sudden, more people start going to see it. Universal's doing a fine job advertising the movie. I see commercials all the time for it, but I think there, again, this is another movie that, when it, you know, it was such an audience pleaser at Toronto this year.
Yeah.
People were assuming that this was going to be one of those adult hits of the season. And now maybe they get it out there next week and they expand it, but you got a lot more stuff coming out. You know, you got a lot of more stuff for the families. You got more adult stuff. You're going to have more award stuff coming down the pike. Mary Poppins is coming out. I mean, it's going to be a very busy time in a couple of weeks. And Green Book is one of those movies that could just get forgotten very quickly.
That's really too bad. I mean, because I love this movie. I love Green Book, mm-hmm. and I wish more people would see it. It's just such an incredibly crowd pleasing film. I mean, it really is. It just works on every level. I love it.
So, yeah, I'm curious to see, you know, because now this is, you know, it's still possible, you know, Universal gets people out to see this movie, but, you know, they're two sort of really big award contenders, this and First Man.
Yeah.
And I hope to God First Man isn't dead because of his box office.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be a really sad commentary, but
absolutely.
You know, but that's what it is. And I just hope that movie doesn't get forgotten, and if you'll see exactly where Universal starts putting all of its eggs.
Yeah. All right. Well, so we're looking at Ralph Breaks the Internet again next week, number one.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to see really pretty much any changes in the box office. So it'll be Ralph, Grinch, Creed 2. Fantastic Beasts, maybe Bohemian Rhapsody jumps up to fourth next week, but you're likely not going to see anything. And we won't know how well Roma does in limited release because Netflix doesn't release their office numbers.
That's right. Well,
so we won't know.
But
it's selling out where it's been playing.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, listen, Eric, thanks a lot, man, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right, there you go. Eric Childress, we talk about the box office, and we'll do it again next week. All right here on WGN. We'll take a break here.